Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. It was a week of numbers, beginning with 500,000, the number of dollars Boston mayoral candidate John Connolly turned down from an outside nonprofit group.
I did not request any contribution. I do not want any contribution, and I have not accepted any contribution. I don't want it.
Another number, 40,000, the number of individuals believed to be affected by a mishandling of evidence at the state's drug lab.
As of today, there are approximately 40,000 names of individuals whose drug samples were associated with chemist Annie Dukin in some way.
And 14, the number of times Jared Remy had been arrested before allegedly killing his girlfriend.
There are some very readily identified red flags.
Then there's one, the number of women currently running for governor of Massachusetts.
I know how to get government to work when it really does matter the most.
And zero, the number of Republicans in the race so far.
I've decided with my wife's blessing that I will not be running for governor of Massachusetts in 2014.
Well, we'll break all these numbers down with our Week in Review panelists right now. Renee Loth is the editor of Architecture Boston and a columnist for the Boston Globe. Good to see you, Renee.
Thank you.
And David Scharfenberg, WBUR online political reporter. David, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
So let's begin with some politics and this race for mayor of Boston with a primary just about a month away. First of all, a new poll from the Boston political consulting system Sage Systems, finds that City Councilor John Connolly and State Representative Marty Walsh are in the lead, more or less tied, with 11 or 12%. Suffolk County DA Dan Connolly is running third with 9%. But David, I'll start with you. The big takeaway seems to be that this race remains pretty fluid. 35% of voters say they are undecided.
Yes, this poll in general is remarkably consistent with a poll from a month ago, Suffolk University Boston Herald poll that had Connolly and Walsh kind of in the top tier, Dan Connolly, Rob Consalvo in the next tier. We have seen Charlotte Goler-Ritchie move up a little bit in this second poll, but they're pretty consistent here. I think there are kind of two ways to look at this. First, you can say the kind of traditional polls are managing to hold on here. We haven't seen much of a breakthrough from some of the kind of newer, younger, fresher faces. On the other hand, since we still have some 35% of the electorate undecided, there's real opportunity for those newer, younger folks to break through. So it kind of depends on how you want to look at it.
Yeah, Renee, and how do you look at it? This 35% of voters say they're undecided. I mean, with a month to go, I'm actually a little surprised that there isn't more sort of passionate commitment around this race.
Yeah, you know, I noticed in that poll that poll was also of likely voters, you know, and so 35% undecided among likely voters, the sort of more casual voters probably have even larger, you know, undecided percentages. I vote in Boston myself, and I have to say that this is the first election that I can remember where I didn't have instantly, you know, my candidate kind of thing. You know, I usually know just who I want to vote for right away, and so I think it's a large field. There's a lot of pent-up, demand because Mayor Menino had been in for so long. And, I think people are just having a hard time focusing and identifying who's who.
And remembering how to think about a race for mayor. I mean, it's been a generation.
Right. Precisely.
Well, also this week, there was a bit of a tussle over outside money in the mayor's race. The national education nonprofit Stand for Children, which is a pro-charter school, pro-school reform group, wanted to throw $500,000 behind candidate John Connolly to help him fund ads, phone banking, door knocking. Facing criticism from other candidates about the money, Connolly refused it, saying he didn't request it, didn't want it, and wouldn't accept it.
I'm deeply worried that such groups are going to warp the debate by making large purchases for TV and radio commercials, and that they're going to open the door for negative campaigning.
Meanwhile, there have been calls from some candidates, including Rob Consalvo, that all the candidates take a Boston pledge and turn down money from all outside special interest groups. David, tell me, we talked to you earlier in the week about this. How is all of this playing out, and how is it affecting the race?
Well, I reported back in May that these education groups were kind of gearing up to spend big money in the race. So I find it a little difficult to swallow this notion that everyone was shocked, you know, that $500,000 would be spent by this group on their candidate of choice. That said, the big splashy headlines turned campaign finance into an issue, at least for the time being. It clearly got some traction, and John Connally decided he had to back off from this cash.
Yeah, and what do you think, Renee? I mean, is it a good thing that campaign finance is sort of front and center, at least for this week, and that outside money, that there might be some brakes put on this outside money?
Yeah, you know, I think the so-called People's Pledge or the Boston Pledge that is modeled after the People's Pledge is easier to enforce in the final, probably, when there's only two candidates and you can actually watch, you know, the flow of money in and out. It's a little bit more complicated with 9 or 10, whatever it is now, mayoral candidates. And, you know, I think that this whole story kind of revealed a certain level of hypocrisy, too, among some of the other candidates who had sought the Stand for Children, you know, endorsement. And then when they didn't get it, turned around and said, oh, hars, you know, we can't have outside money. but, you know, all things being equal, it's good to have a campaign that is, you know, homegrown and not, you know, manipulated by big money forces from outside corporate or special interest. There is a big question yet hanging, though, about whether the union monies that candidate Walsh is, you know, attracting, does that constitute outside money or not?
Interesting question.
Well, let's move on to another political question that has to do with gubernatorial politics. First off, former Senator Scott Brown made this much-anticipated announcement this week.
I've decided, with my wife's blessing, that I will not be running for governor of Massachusetts in 2014.
I'm sure in coming weeks we'll discuss what he might be running for, but that leaves the door open for Republicans such as Charlie Baker. But no one from the GOP has officially announced in the Massachusetts governor's race yet. On the Democratic side, Juliette Kayyem, former Homeland Security Advisor to Governor Deval Patrick and President Obama, has decided she will run.
I've spent my career dealing with preparing society, the homeland, for whatever may come. And it was at that moment that I looked at the landscape in Massachusetts and thought maybe there was something about my leadership and my experience that I could offer to the voters, or at least begin to communicate my vision for Massachusetts.
So, Renee, let's start with you. What's your reaction to Juliette Kayyem throwing her hat into the race?
Well, you know, I know Juliette a little bit from, we're colleagues at the Boston Globe, so I just want to preface that. You know, I guess I'm surprised. I had heard that she was thinking of running. I didn't really expect her to throw her hat into the ring because it's a difficult thing. She's got 3 young children. But, you know, I understand that.
Wait, let me stop you right there. Yeah. What difference does it make that she has children? Because there are many male candidates who are running who've got children, too. We've gone over this territory, but I get nailed for this every time I ask that. I mention that, but yeah. It's an issue. I mean, for women candidates in general,
I think they're probably all quite young. I can't say exactly. I do know that a number of activists and advocates for women in public office came to her and asked her to run, Barbara Lee and that gang. You know, there's no reason why somebody who is a non-traditional candidate, who is not somebody who holds public office, couldn't win, especially given the experience of Elizabeth Warren and Deval Patrick recently. The state is ready for that kind of candidate. So I do think she has an opportunity here.
You're a good sport to take my gentle pushback there. David, let's hear from you about Juliette Kayyem.
Yeah, I mean, I think she's obviously a very smart and charismatic person, and she'll have an impact here. But I think she's got a bit of an uphill fight. Gender, as we just heard, does matter in elections. And Martha Coakley, most people expect to hop into this race. She's certainly the bigger name. It's going to be tough for Juliette to overcome that. I also think she's kind of putting forward her experience on Homeland Security, saying, just like I kind of prepared the country to deal with difficulty, I will prepare Massachusetts for its future. It's a little bit of a stretch to kind of connect those two things. So I think that'll be a problem for her as well.
Before we depart from the governor's race from this week, let's talk briefly about Dan Wolf, who says that he is going to resign from or drop out of the governor's race if the State Ethics Commission continues to demand that he cut ties between Cape Air, his company, And himself, the Ethics Commission has cited that it's a conflict of interest, given the fact that Cape Air flies in and out of Logan Airport. He basically says if they continue to make this demand, he's dropping out of the race. So, Renee, what do you make of Dan Wolf saying, you know, I got to stay with Cape Air and I can't run for governor and I can't cut ties?
Well, you know, I don't know about getting an exemption from the state ethics rules. You know that they are the rules. And apparently, according to the State Ethics Commission, they had told Dan Wolf 2.5 years ago when he was running for the legislature that he would be in violation. So he's kind of ignored the ethics rules already now for a couple of years. You know, maybe the ethics rules need to be reexamined. I know that there are many quirks of the ethics laws. I recall at one point reporting that, you know, you weren't allowed under the nepotism laws to hire your brother-in-law if it was your sister's husband, but if it was your wife's brother, it was okay. I mean, there are a lot of confusions in those laws, and they probably do need a review. But I really can't get behind an exemption from one candidate.
Now, David, Dan Wolf released this statement yesterday, which says, in part, ending all leases and operating agreements between Cape Air and Massport would effectively prohibit Cape Air from serving Logan. It could lead to the loss of 1,000 jobs, and air service to 11 communities that rely on Cape Air. And he says that is not an option he can, in good conscience, pursue.
Yeah, Cape Air is really at the center of his political identity. He's built this business. He's employed lots of folks. That was at the center of his message when he first launched his campaign. And so destroying Cape Air to run for governor would be problematic, even from a political perspective. I think the real winner in this, if he does indeed remain out of the race, is Steve Grossman, who had a remarkably similar message. He touted his private sector experience. And like Dan Wolf, he said, we've got to make sure we bring along those folks who have not benefited from the Massachusetts economy.
Let's turn quickly to the case of Jared Remy. That's the son of Red Sox broadcaster Jerry Remy, who allegedly stabbed and killed his girlfriend, Jennifer Martel, this past week. The day before her death, Remy was arrested for assaulting Martel, but was then released without bail. An emergency restraining order against him was lifted the next day when Martel did not show up in court and renew it. She was found dead later that night. So a lot of questions have been raised about how prosecutors handled this case. Middlesex District Attorney Marion Ryan called for an independent review of how her office handled it. Here she is this week on NECN.
Anyone looking at a process engaged in, no matter how thoughtful or careful, where there then is a situation that occurs where there's the loss of life in this case, would be irresponsible in not thinking about looking at that process. Is there something else that could be done, something that could be changed?
You know, Renee, there were so many red flags around this case, including 14 previous offenses, many, at least three of them involving women. Did her office, did DA's, Ryan's office mishandle this case?
Well, let me first say that a lot of people have commented on the celebrity aspect of this case, and I have to say that the celebrity or notoriety of this of the name Remy has really sort of brought attention to a pattern of domestic violence that in every other respect is quite typical. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not unusual for victims not to want to bring charges against their abusers. It's not unusual for DAs and prosecutors not to pursue charges without the victim's support. It's also tragically not unusual for violence to escalate to a kind of lethal level when at precisely the moment where the usually the woman decides that she wants to leave the relationship. So these are all things that happened. They're not unusual. And I think, it's good in a way that this is heightening awareness of these kinds of problems. They need to be addressed at every level, socially, in terms of the justice system, and, you know, in terms of media attention even.
David, what was your takeaway from this? I mean, it's a really tragic story, obviously.
Yeah. What really kind of strikes me here is the sort of confounding complexity of these cases. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got this kind of dangerousness law that would allow you, in theory, to preemptively take someone like Remy off the streets before he could go back home and wage this kind of violence. But it's really difficult to invoke that law without the involvement of the victim. Research suggests that victims often are the best judge of what sort of violence, what sort of danger they might be in at home. And so you kind of have to respect that judgment. And pursuing that sort of dangerousness law can actually lead to more danger at home while the process is ongoing. So it's a really complex, thorny issue. I know the state is going to look at it again, and it's going to be tough.
And speaking of complexities, I mean, this point was made on our show by a couple of advocates that for victims of domestic violence, navigating the criminal justice system, the healthcare system, the mental health system, any one of those systems is complicated enough. And for a potential victim or an actual victim to have to navigate all three or four of those, it's a real challenge.
Well, speaking of criminal justice, let's move on briefly to one last topic this week, and that is the ongoing fallout from the state drug lab chemist Annie Ducan. Governor Patrick's administration says that it now believes she may have mishandled thousands more drug samples than previously believed, up to around 40,000 individuals whose drug samples were associated with her, 40,000. So we've got some reaction here from Matthew Sagal, legal director of the ACLU Massachusetts, who says that all these cases should now be handled as one group.
We cannot do this on a case-by-case basis. It's too costly, and it makes no sense. These cases should be addressed using broad categories. In every case where someone has served their time, it is not worth a prosecutor's time or a taxpayer's dollar to save that conviction.
Renee, briefly, it seems as if it's been a year since this story broke. Mm-hmm. It's been a long time now, and the state isn't really that much closer to taking significant steps on how to handle all these cases. So, I mean, do you think that there's something more the administration could be doing? Maybe group them, as the ACLU suggests.
Well, you know, I think that they've already spent something like $7 million, the state has, in reprocessing some claims. 330 people or something like that have been released already. So some things have been happening on this front. But, it's the idea that 40,000 cases need to be reviewed or retried. It's just mind-boggling, and it's this woman really was like the typhoid Mary of the public health system and the justice system. I mean, it's just astonishing how much sabotage one person can do.
David?
I was going to say something along those lines. I mean, we've been with this story for a year now. It's kind of easy to forget the depth of it, and that it took a year to just count the number of cases here, I think, says as much as anything about the kind of level of systemic failure here and the ripple effects to go on. And we're talking still millions and millions of dollars and potentially years and years of action here.
Hubbubs. Time to move on to the hubbubs, those stories that Magna and I have this wordless way of communicating, and sometimes we actually forget to say
it
out loud.
Our Vulcan mind meld broke at that moment.
So that story that didn't make it above the fold. David, let's go to your hubbub.
Okay, my hubbub sounds a little like this.
Cast your vote September 24th!
Vote Consalvo.
He's our man.
Yeah. Love it.
Yeah. He's all in. I went hip hop. That's right. You know, Boston has a rich tradition of political songs going back to Charlie on the MTA. I don't think this one is quite the folk song that was. But I have to say, I was prepared to fully mock this, and I kind of like it.
Yeah, let's bring
it
up.
Admit it.
Bring
I kind of like
for
it.
Just for 1 second.
Want to make it happen, vote Consalvo for mayor. He's the man about the action.
Fantastic. Well, I would say we should just stop right there, but Renee, try to top that
oh,
one.
Oh, God, I don't think I can, but okay, here we go. Few things are more pleasant on a summer day than the fresh laundry drying in the breeze, but as you probably know, many communities ban clotheslines as unsightly, even though they are very good for the environment compared to clothes dryers. Now, State Senator Mike Barrett of Lexington is running to the rescue with a right to dry bill, which he filed at the behest of a constituent. So the ban would be lifted, although there would still be local approval involved. Still, when you think about this fact, which is that clothes dryers use 66 billion kilowatt hours of energy a year, those ugly clotheslines, they start to look a lot better.
Wow. What about you, Megan?
So, Anthony, remind me, the socks are in
second place.
I think they regained
right
first place, if I have that
they
right.
Did
I think
regain
we're, I think
first
we're
place.
A game ahead of Tampa Bay.
Okay, right. So my hubbub is someone else regarding the Red Sox is in first place, and he happens to be the front runner for the mayor's race in New York City, Bill de Blasio. Blasio? Blasio, who grew up in Cambridge and is a confessed passionate Red Sox fan, is now leading the race for mayor in New York City. Enough said.
That will be interesting. So here's my hubbub. It shouldn't be a hubbub at all because it was on the front page of the Globe. but I like the article so much about Somerville, which apparently has grown so hip that it's worrying itself. That was the headline. a lot of focus on Union Square, which happens to be my part of town. But, you know, it's been invaded by fancy restaurants, brew pubs, high-end pizza purveyors, and the hipsters. And in general, here's the definition. Hipsters are known and admired or mocked for riding fixed-gear bikes, wearing suit vests and thick glasses frames, adopting hobbies like chicken raising, and affecting snobbery for microbrews and general more ironic than now attitude. And the article goes on and talks about some really serious stuff, like with this gentrification, let's hope the city of Somerville also keeps its eyes on housing, affordability, schools, parking, all those kinds of things that make it also livable for working class people. So, really interesting piece.
Yeah, Slummerville no more.
Long way from Slummerville.
Well, David Scharfenberg is WBUR's online political reporter. David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Renee Loth, editor of Architecture Boston and columnist for the Boston Globe. Renee, thanks again.
A pleasure.
And stay with us, a lot more to come. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.